You're listening to The Healthy Sensitive. Hello, and welcome everyone to The Healthy Sensitive. It has been a while. It's been a minute. I retreated from a lot of content creation that includes blogging, writing on my own, and podcasting. So part of that absence, I think, was just due to the fact that I was getting kind of at my wit's end with the world, and every time I would sit down to record a podcast, it ended up being some kind of commentary on what was going on out there. And I thought, I don't really think anyone needs my additional 2 cents or more noise. And so I thought, I'm just going to wait. I'm going to wait until whatever it is I have to say is not more crazy making content. So here we are, almost a year later. Anyway, first of all, some housekeeping. I am very, very excited, ladies and gentlemen, because I am officially leaving my post as anchored employee working for a larger organization, and I'm shifting my work style into more of a portfolio method. What I mean by that is I am now going to be fully launched into my private practice. It's been going well, and I have to tell you, every time I'm like having conversations with people that are my people and I'm coaching people one-on-one, I feel so invigorated. I feel so privileged and fully alive. And it's such an honor to be able to have those kinds of conversations with people that I just feel, that experience where you meet someone and you think, oh, same team. We get each other. It doesn't just have to be romantic. It can just be any number of contexts. It can be platonic. Like, I felt this way when I met a really close friend of mine, a couple actually, where I just sat across the table, we're eating lunch, and I thought, oh, you poor thing. I've decided we're friends now, and I don't know that I'm going to give you much of a say. Of course, I don't mean that, but it's that feeling, that sense of just, hey, I know you. And that's how it feels when I'm coaching people in my private practice. And so I want more of that. And I want to be more available for more of that. And so starting May 30th, so as I'm recording this, it is May 15th, 2022. Starting May 30th, 2022, I will no longer be just a part-time coach and part-time educator. I am going to be fully fledged, fully immersed in my private practice. So very, very excited. I will be more active on social media, but that's going to be a very slow trickle. So stay tuned. I'll let you know when you can, if you would like to follow me. I have a very ambivalent relationship with social media. So there's that. I see it as a fabulous tool. I just want to make sure that when I'm using it, I don't fall prey to its shadow side. And that's talk about content creation, a whole nother branch that I've been not avoiding, but just purposefully, intentionally, just keeping it at a distance. And all of that is about to change, and I'm really excited. So I'm squealing on the inside, but I'm trying not to squeal into the microphone because that's an obnoxious sound. Thank you for letting me gush. Now, onto the content. Today, now that housekeeping is done, I want to speak to perfectionism. And first of all, before I even get started, I want to give a huge shout out to a friend. I'm not going to use her name because I don't want to do that to somebody without having said, hey, I'm just going to go ahead and throw your name and blast it into the cyberspace. But it is a phenomenal human being I got into a wonderful conversation with. And we talked about perfectionism. And I said, well, I'm so glad we're having this conversation. Now I know what I'm going to do my podcast on when I relaunch again. So here I am. So a huge measure of gratitude for that conversation and for that wonderful person. So now, why perfectionism? Why would I start there and launch into that place? Well, just to give a little bit of background, I actually did my master's thesis on perfectionism. I may have mentioned that in one of my previous episodes, now that I'm saying this. Apologies if I did. But in case I did not, when I was a busy little graduate student, I decided I would do my final project on perfectionism. And it was the classic example of research turning into me-search. I was falling prey to a triad of woes: perfectionism, adrenal fatigue, and depression. And what I was noticing about this triangle meets spiral is that it seemed to feed into one another. So I was desperately trying to do everything perfectly all the time, and that's exhausting, especially when there's a lot going on. So at the time I was going through graduate school, I was working full-time as an instructor and then taking night classes as a student. So my poor little brain was doing all kinds of absorbing and regurgitating content. And in an attempt to do everything perfectly, especially given how many plates I had spinning, I noticed that I was starting to dig into reserves. So I was no longer keeping up, sort of like if you're budgeting your finances. And let's imagine you have an amount of savings in your savings account, and at the same time you're making an income. And there are times in our lives where if we're being attentive to our finances, we spend a little bit more than we make, but it's okay because on the whole, on balance, we spend less on average. So as an example, 6 months might go by where I'm continuously spending less than I'm making, and then maybe I get hit with a financial hardship and need to dig into my savings account. Just to give this as a precursor, as an analogy. That's sort of where I was at with my energy. As a young person, I was in my early 20s, and I was doing things that help fuel my fuel tank in terms of energy. Like, I was exercising regularly. I was being very attentive to my nutrition protocols. Those were probably the two primary things. However, I was still spending more than I was making, if we're talking about spending in terms of energy. I was perpetually, highly activated. So I don't just want to say stressed, because stress has such a massive connotation, and it's a negative one for most of us. And it wasn't all bad. I really enjoyed what I was studying. I was studying holistic health education. So that, talk about my wheelhouse. It was a joy to learn, but it was just still a lot. It was a lot of expending of energy. And then add into that being an instructor, which I also love. So neither of these two things were, life-threatening. It wasn't the kind of stress where, let's just put it this way. There's real hardships happening in the world where people are truly being, thrown against a hurricane's worth of challenges. That was not my situation. My situation was what a practitioner that I work with calls death by opportunity, where I say yes to everything because all of it sounds great, and then realize too late that the things I've committed myself to are perhaps stretching me too far. So there I was, spending energetically more than I was making. And I was doing that for 4 years. And even at 22, 23, 24, etc., you can do it, but even when you're youthful and you have a savings account that has not yet been spent, it takes a toll. And it did take a toll. And so what I started to wonder by year 3 of my program is if maybe the pattern that I was falling into, perfectionism leading me to overexert myself, which was leading to adrenal fatigue. Now, pause here. The term adrenal fatigue, I should say, there's some contention in a number of, say, health and wellness circles. When you talk about that with, say, a naturopathic doctor or I would say often traditional modalities, using that kind of language often will be met with affirmation, a validation. In the medical arena, so if you're going to a hospital, if you're seeking mainstream medical doctor, they feel like this is not language that's appropriate for health and wellness. They think it's sort of a made-up thing. They don't really see adrenal fatigue as an actual, thing. They won't diagnose anything as it relates to adrenal glands until there's adrenal failure. So that's just something to note. And this is not a criticism of mainstream medicine or of Western medicine anymore. And it's also not necessarily a celebration of traditional modalities. I'm just letting you know where I'm coming from on this. When I say adrenal fatigue, I'm talking about that experience where you feel tired but wired. So it's a physical and emotional exhaustion that feels like it's bone crushing. But yet you try and get into bed and sleep is elusive. You can't get to it. So insomnia hits and it makes zero sense because you're exhausted. So this is the tired but wired. And what, again, this is now coming from my graduate background. What's happening is the adrenal glands are producing cortisol, adrenaline, and the body is having to be hypervigilant in order to sort of meet the demands of a stressful life circumstance. And if that adrenaline and cortisol is just pumping through the system and there's no way to, as the Nagoski sisters would say, complete the stress cycle, if you can't keep up with the stress. So I'm feeling intense activation and then I immediately go out for a run. Well, I've completed the stress cycle. Adrenaline and cortisol kicked into the body and then I went for a run and came back down. The likelihood in that scenario is that I will probably still be able to get adequate amounts of sleep that evening, provided the stress that I felt during the day was more or less equal to the tools I had at my disposal to complete that stress cycle. But what can happen is we're producing cortisol, adrenaline, pumping, and I can't keep up. So all of my tools, even if I am still exercising and meditating and eating well, I'm nevertheless feeling so much activation that I can't complete the stress cycles fast enough. And what happens then is I still have this sort of excess of cortisol and adrenaline in my system, such that even though I'm physically tired, so I'm still producing melatonin, and in that regard, I'm sleepy, but I'm not producing, let's say, for example, enough GABA, which is a neurotransmitter responsible for sort of chomping down on the excitatory neurons in the system. So my body in that state will try and overcompensate. It helps to think of it this way. If you're out in the jungle and there's a predator lurking about, you want your body to be able to override your exhaustion and overcompensate by producing these stress hormones. This is not an inherently good or bad thing. It's a survival mechanism. And it's a pretty neat trick. It's just not helpful in modern day society because our systems are behaving as if there's this perpetual predator hanging out and lurking in the shadows when in fact there isn't. And so we're staying awake at night, exhausted, tired but wired. And then if you don't get adequate sleep, you don't get a proper reboot. And then you start off the following morning with more cortisol in the system than you would otherwise, which makes you more sensitive to stress, such that things that otherwise wouldn't bother you suddenly are getting on your nerves. This is why when someone cuts you off on the freeway Sunday at 3 p.m., after you've had a full day's rest, you think, that was annoying. Shrug. Versus if you're running late and it's Thursday morning and you've had 4 days of stressful events take place and not adequate amounts of sleep, you're at least internally contemplating all kinds of violent thoughts that you don't act upon but are nevertheless feeling. And your interpretation of that event is wildly different. So this is what I mean when I'm talking about what's going on with these adrenal glands. So I was wondering if perhaps this situation where, okay, the perfectionism, which leads to the adrenal fatigue, that then over time started to lead into something that felt an awful lot like depression. So there's now apathy, a sense of, you know, loss of interest in things that I used to love, perpetual bone-crushing sadness that didn't correlate with the objective reality that was my life. So I'm not talking about depression that comes online when a loved one dies. That's not depression. That's melancholy. It's sadness. It's anguish, perhaps. But it's appropriate. You know, when life is truly difficult. So if you're talking about a refugee who's just lost their home and has just had to be transplanted into a wildly new environment and who doesn't know what's coming next, and let's say they stumble into a conversation with a therapist and this person says, God, I think I might be depressed. The therapist would say, no, you are not depressed. Your life sucks right now. And you're feeling the appropriate emotional response to that suckage. That's very different than, I have enough food in the refrigerator. I have a refrigerator that's turned on. My electricity bill is paid. I'm physically safe. My job, I haven't been laid off. Like, nothing has happened that is truly terrible. And yet here I am feeling as if I were a refugee. That's depression. And that, my friends, is terrifying. Because at least when you're feeling those feels around true hardship, it feels congruent. It doesn't feel comfortable, but it feels like sanity. But when the emotions that are percolating and coming online are wildly out of line with what's happening objectively in your life, that is a very scary place to be. And this is the triangle I found myself in. And I thought, I wonder if other people get caught in this trap, or if it's just a unique thing to me. Like, maybe I'm the only crazy person on the planet who works her butt off like crazy, like gets her system burned out all the way into the ground, and then feels really depressed about that, which you would think would lead me to be less perfectionistic, but in fact aggravated my perfectionism further, because now I'm thinking, well, I really have to be perfect because I've lost my discernment. I've lost my perspective. Because I'm tired. Haven't you seen a toddler who's tired? They have no sense of perspective. You know, something wrong happens and they're just bereft, sobbing. This happens to us adults too. So, now you, all of that was just background, and we're quite a ways into this. So, buckle up, buttercup. This is going to be a long one. So now, what I'm now curious about, having done all of that work, at the time I was not focused primarily on highly sensitive people. I had that in the back burner of my own awareness as an individual, but I wasn't fully immersed in how having a more vigilant nervous system inherently would maybe predispose someone to this cycle triangle. Whew. So in this podcast, in this episode, that's basically where I'm trying to guide toward. I want to talk a bit about what I mean by perfectionism. I'm going to kind of break that down into sort of textbook definitions, what you might find in the DSM, or at the very least in psychology circles. And I'll talk, I've said this over and over again, the characteristics of what a highly sensitive person often looks like. And I'm basing that off of Elaine Aaron's research. And I'll talk about why there might be overlap or correlation, a high correlation between the kind of person who identifies as being sensitive and the kind of person who might be prone to perfectionism. From there, that's when I'm going to start talking about, all right, well, great. What do we do about it? Because that seems important. I don't want to just be all doom and gloom and say, yeah, sorry, fellow HSPs, you're probably going to get super perfectionistic and that's going to be exhausting for you. And well, sorry. No, I'm going to be pulling from research that talks about how we can navigate these really, really just treacherous waters. And a lot of that research is going to be coming from, yeah, I mean, you knew it would happen, folks. Brené Brown's work, coming straight from her book, The Gifts of Imperfection, which, by the way, if you have not read it or heard of it, please go pick it up immediately, because it's Brené Brown, guys. Just do it. And if you don't know who Brené Brown is, that's fine. But please, for your own benefit, go ahead and fix that just as soon as possible. But I'll also be bringing in work from the Nagoski sisters, and they wrote the book called Burnout and, you know, Completing the Stress Cycle. I'll be bringing in other works, sort of, you know, sprinkling in content from, you know, people like Howard Thurman, you know, people who've written on the power of being willing to be disliked and all the things. So just to give you a little bit of background into what to expect. So let's start with perfectionism. What do I mean by perfectionism? Because there is some serious confusion around this term. And in fact, depending on, let's say you just do a cursory Google search on the word perfectionism. As you're searching it, you might notice there's some people who see their, who will have four concepts of perfectionism, or even five. So they might say, oh, well, here's the versions of perfectionism that are not good, and here's one that's healthy. And other researchers will say, no, there's no such thing as any amount of healthy perfectionism. There is healthy striving. But as soon as you use the word perfectionism, you already have something that is damn near a diagnosis. So I, just to give you a sense, fall into that second category. I do not believe that there is such a thing as any healthy perfectionism. And there are people who will disagree with me on that and who will use different language. I believe there is perfectionism and healthy striving. They are distinct. So we'll start with perfectionism. There's, depending on who you look to and what research you follow, most folks agree that there's these three primary ways that perfectionism can manifest. So one is socially prescribed perfectionism. So socially prescribed perfectionism is when you're someone who is highly aware, super, super vigilant about the way that you perceive that others perceive you. People who fall into this category are hyper aware of the culture. So they might be fixated on their fashion sense. They will not leave the house without proper makeup or their hair done or the latest trending fashion that of the hour. People who fall in this category often will be much more interested in how others are seeing them than how they are seeing themselves. Not because they don't care about how they see themselves, but because there's so much noise that's overwhelming the system. So their orientation is to hurry up, look outside of themselves and say, what does the world need of me? And then become that. So socially prescribed perfectionism is, how do I keep up with the Joneses? How do I mimic those who are successful in my environment? That's socially prescribed perfectionism. I'm trying to keep up with you guys. I'm looking outside of me, seeing what success has been deemed, or, you know, how it's defined, and then mimicking it. Then there's other-oriented perfectionism. This is probably the one that triggers me the most because I really don't like it. Other-oriented is when I'm now imposing the need for you to be perfect. So this is what it might look like when you have a very hyper-vigilant partner who's insisting that you fluff or, you know, I need you to be perfect. Other-oriented perfectionism might come from parents who are desperately trying to get their kiddo to behave perfectly, often from a place of fear. So I'm not talking about abusive parenting. I'm talking about a parent who loves their child and who is terrified that their child will get rejected. And in order to prevent rejection for their child, they are going above and beyond and enforcing perfectionism onto their child. This is exhausting to feel. Really, really difficult to be the recipient of this. And then finally, there's self-oriented perfectionism. So this is where you have a gremlin inside of your brain that is perpetually telling you that you're not enough. Oh, you got an A on that paper, but it's only because they missed this typo. Oh yeah, sure, you got that promotion, but you don't actually deserve it. This is where imposter syndrome lives, in this self-oriented perfection. There's no amount of external validation or feedback that can be given that seems to be able to squash the voice of this inner critic who's insisting that you are not enough. You will never be enough. Not that you didn't do enough, but that you are just not enough as a human being. You don't deserve to be here inherently. So you better work your butt off to make sure no one else figures that out. That's self-oriented. Now, all of that is very different from, now this is, I know Brené Brown speaks to this, but she's not the only one. Different from healthy striving. So healthy striving is self-focused. Healthy striving is about trying to stretch and push the boundaries of what we think is possible, but it's based on doing that in a way that is in alignment with our values and our wants. So healthy striving looks like I want to be a leader in this organization. I'm going to strive for that. And in order to achieve that desire, I'm going to look to others who have been successful, and maybe I'll do some informal interviewing. I'm going to work really hard. I'm going to ask for feedback. I'm going to take on extra hours at work. I'm going to do research on effective leadership. Like, I want to be a leader, and I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen. And the reason I want to be a leader is because I'm looking at the world right now and seeing that we need effective leadership, and I think I can be that person. I value my relationships, and I want to be someone who is able to spread my wings and cover my people and protect them and lead us toward the change that we need to see in the world. These are the kinds of folks who will work 70 hours a week and who don't ever seem exhausted. And when you ask them, it's because it doesn't even feel like it's coming from them. They'll often use language like, I am a vessel. Like, I want this thing, and I want this thing the way I want to breathe. I could do nothing else. If you told me I was going to be wealthy and I won the lottery, I would still be spending 70 hours of my week doing this thing, because this is my dharma, my purpose, my sense of it's in alignment with my values. So healthy striving is about reaching. It's enthusiasm. It's desire. Perfectionism is about numbing. It's about wearing armor. It's about doing anything we can to reduce our vulnerability. It's about looking at the world and saying, you can't touch this. If as long as I do everything perfectly all the time and I don't show any indication of sweat or of strain, then you cannot take me down. That's different from healthy striving. Healthy striving is, I'm going to go for it. And if I fall on my ass, worth it, because this is bigger than me. So that's the background, what I'm talking about, of, you know, when I'm referring to perfectionism versus healthy striving. Now, I'm going to pivot a little bit here, and I'm going to talk once again about traits that are inherent in Elaine Aaron's description of a highly sensitive person. Now, just as some background for maybe you're somebody who's just now stumbling onto this concept and you just happened to Google search HSPs and you just fell in my podcast, so you've never heard of any of this stuff, but you're curious. Elaine Aaron, PhD in psychology, so very brilliant woman, did some research and I don't know how to put this into words. There seemed to be a pattern that emerged in her work with her clients, where there was a subgroup of people who seemed to have nervous systems that were just more vigilant. They had these traits that were common enough amongst each other that it seemed like it was worth looking into, but not so common. Like, it wasn't wasn't a small enough number for it to be like a disorder. But it wasn't large enough for it to be a universal trait. And when she did some digging, what she determined is not only is there a real bona fide trait circulating in our population, but it's also in hundreds of other species. So in hundreds of species, including our own, there's about 20 to 30% that have a more vigilant nervous system. And you can identify these individuals by virtue of these four characteristics. The first is depth of processing. So these are people or animals. We're all animals as far as I'm concerned, but you know, take that as you will. Depth of processing, these are your deep thinkers. They like to chew on things. They don't just take anything at face value. They dig deep. Give them a concept, and that will tickle their little senses for hours, potentially. They like to think about the connections between things. So in what way can we map the trends of economics alongside the trends of psychology? How are they connected? In what way can we use this action film as a metaphor to depict our cultural representation of other countries? These are the kinds of connections that these folks will make. So they think long, hard, and deep. They like to chew on ideas. The next is over-arousal. So this is the language I use to describe this, you know, because everyone has a window of arousal that is their optimal sweet spot. Everyone, every person, every animal, you name it, they've got it. And I'm going to just arbitrarily use numbers for this scale. You can change your numbers or whatever, but imagine you've got a scale from 1 to 10. And 1 is very, very under-aroused, and 10 is super, super over-aroused. FYI, by aroused, I'm not talking about sex. So arousal is activation, degree of interest, degree of energy getting kind of elicited from the system. Most people, I would say, have a window, an optimal window of, let's say, I don't know, let's say 2 to 8. So if their arousal window falls below a 2, they're bored. Apathetic, depressed. This is the person who's been told to sit alone for 2 hours and they're waiting and waiting and they're thinking, my God, I'm so bored. And that doesn't feel good. And then above an 8 is I'm anxious. So there's so much going on that my system is getting overwhelmed. So a person might feel this if they got caught in the midst of a protest that suddenly turned into a riot. Like, it was invigorating, now it's gone overboard, and now I'm terrified. So below a 2, not so good. Below an 8, not so good. But somewhere between, 3 to 7, we're solid. We're pretty good. And we're perpetually, all of us, perpetually are navigating this window. We're not doing it consciously. So when I'm bored, I might call a friend, but at some point that gets tiring, so I get off the phone with the friend, and I read a book. But the book becomes a little boring, so I turn on Netflix to watch an action movie, but then that becomes a little too intense, so I shut that off. This is what we do with our arousal window. Sensitive people have a lower ceiling. So instead of it being a 2 to an 8, a sensitive person might, for them to be over-aroused, maybe it's a 6 or a 7. So their ceiling is just a little lower. This also means, by the way, that they're not easily bored. They just are easily overactivated. So a sensitive person is somebody who might say, oh, I love music. Not a huge fan of rock concerts, though. It's just so much. I can't even hear the music through the crowd. Ugh. They might say, oh, I love traveling to new places, but I hate the airport. Ugh, what a mess. They might say they really enjoy meeting new people, but they're not wildly enthusiastic about networking events. They would rather more intimate connections. And this starts to sound a little bit like introvert versus extrovert, but in fact, I mean, most sensitive people do also tend to be introverted, but I think it's something like 30% of sensitives identify as extroverted. So just because you're sensitive does not mean you are an introvert. It just means, you might be fed by connection with other people, but you just want the volume turned down. So no, I need my people, but I just need it to be in a cafe and not at a massive convention. So that's over-arousal. The next trait that's associated with sensitivity is emotional sensitivity. And I might go further and say emotional granularity. So this is now coming from research by both Lisa Feldman Barrett as well as Mark Brackett. And when they talk about emotions, they're talking about granularity. The more emotionally intelligent, so to speak, I'm putting that in quotations, a person is, often the more granular they can get about their emotional vocabulary. So a sensitive person is often someone who can utilize, they would not just have happy, sad, and pissed off. Happy, sad, I feel like I'm missing one. Yeah, those are the big three. Someone who's sensitive often can go much more granular. I feel content, tranquil. I feel jubilant, overjoyed. I feel apathy, frustration, agitation, fury. I feel sadness, melancholy. I feel anguish. They can use these much more specific words to determine their very specific experience. So they often are very granular, and they frequently are not only adept at identifying their own emotions, but can quite frequently be equally good at guesstimating the emotional landscape of others. This is not universal, because many of us will make assumptions about what we think people are feeling and end up being wrong. But on balance, the more sensitive a person is, they tend to be right more often. Never perfectly, but more frequently. And then the final one, so that's emotional sensitivity. The final one is sensory sensitivity, which is related. I mean, emotions are senses of a sort. Emotions are concepts that we build around our sensory input. So sensory sensitivity, this just the superficial example of this is someone who walks into the break room and goes, oh God, who had tuna? And then maybe your coworker said, well, I did, but last Tuesday, it's been a week. How do you still smell that? This is someone who says, oh God, I hate fluorescent lighting. It just gives me a headache. They also, though, might see in more vivid color. So they're able to identify more colors in a painting frequently, but not always. So sensitivity does not just mean vulnerability or weakness. It really does mean the ability of a person to respond to one's environment. The more sensitive a person is, the more quickly one responds to changes and inputs in their environment. There's a reason why this gene did not get weeded out of the gene pool. I'll take it to the field. If you're imagining yourself in, say, an antelope, you're an antelope and you're in a pack. I don't even know if you call them a pack, but you get the idea. A predator comes on the scene, and predators are, they've evolved to be very good at hiding and very good at sneaking up on their prey because they got to eat. But if you have a sensitive antelope in your group, they're going to be much more attuned to their environment. They're going to notice these subtle changes. Subtle shift in the sense in the air, a noise, a slightly different color in the wheat that, oh, that's a lion. Like, and then that antelope can freak out and tell all the other antelopes, or run like crazy to indicate to the other antelopes, there is a predator in our midst. We gots to go. You want that in your group. However, there's also a reason why it's remained only about 20 to 30-ish% of the pack in humanity as well as in other species. Sensitivity, people who are sensitive often are not as willing or able to take risk. You need people in your pack who are willing to venture off to new pastures and find greener grasses for everybody to eat. You need people who are willing, you need humans in our group who are willing to take a risk, come up with a new invention, build a new company, be a ball buster. Like, we need that in our lives. And hence why, on balance, it's about 80-ish percent of people who don't identify as sensitive and consistently come up that way, and about 20 to 30-ish percent who do. Because you can see where this would be, in some sense, a superpower. Like, imagine if your beloved is sensitive and can intuit your every need. But now imagine that your partner is sensitive and is being hypervigilant and attempting to intuit your every need when you don't need them to, and you just want them to relax, calm down. So we're sweet, but we're neurotic. So the shadow side of this depth of processing can be neuroses. We can overthink things. You know, there's people in sort of entrepreneurial spheres who say imperfect action is always better than perfect inaction. You know, you can be a perfect planner, but you got to put it in motion at some point. So all of that deep thinking, we can get lost in our thoughts and not actually do anything. So over arousal, it means we're very easy to amuse, but it also means we're very easy to overwhelm. Well, that's annoying. That's not necessarily a superpower. Emotional sensitivity. Well, they're very attuned to their own emotions and everyone else's, but sometimes we need to be able to do hard things despite our emotional misgivings. And then sensory sensitivity. Well, it's great to be able to sense changes in our environment, but if we're too sensitive, we're never going to be willing to take a risk, and sometimes we need to. So the pros and cons. So here we come into perfectionism. Why, one might ask, might a sensitive person be prone to perfectionism? Well, if you're someone who's sensitive to the feelings of other people, that means that you're going to be more likely to feel their feels. So here's what often happens. Someone walks in the room. Hey, I'm going to need you to do this project. Let's say it's my boss or a colleague. I need this project done, but I don't actually have capacity to do it. I could say no, but if I do, it will disappoint them. So if I disappoint them, I will feel their disappointment. And now not only do I have to reckon with my own feelings, but I'm feeling their feels. And oh, no, I can't. I don't want to deal with that. I'd rather just lose some sleep tonight and do the thing and make you feel good. Because if I don't disappoint you, at least I only have to deal with my own fatigue, not my fatigue mixed with your disappointment. Another example, as it relates to relationships. You know, I want to people please, because anger, if you remember, all emotions are sensory data that we just create a concept around. So, oh, I'm feeling butterflies in my tummy. My heart's racing. I have sweaty palms. Well, maybe that's nervousness. I certainly would call it nervousness if I'm about to give a live presentation to hundreds of people. Maybe, though, if instead I change the context and I tell you that my beloved just walked in and we've just started dating and well, now it's not so much nervousness as it is excitement. Same sensory data, but new context. So in terms of our relationships, if there's conflict that comes about, conflict is highly activating. There's heart pounding, the adrenaline, the cortisol, and my spidey senses are highly attuned to all of that. So it can be physically painful for anyone to have conflict, but especially for sensitive folks. So to avoid that conflict, I'm just going to be a happy, peppy person all the time. I will meet all of your needs. You can see where this goes. So if I were to look at all three of the perfectionism types, socially prescribed, again, is I am looking outside of myself for cues from my culture, and I'm trying to mimic what the culture tells me is the ideal. Well, a highly sensitive person would be very likely to do that because they're already feeling a bit self-conscious about their sensitivity, especially if you happen to live in a culture that values go-getters, robust, ballsy types. Like, for example, I don't know, I'm just going to throw one out there. The United States. Like, we love us some Tony Robbins, some Gary Vaynerchuk. We love us some people who go out there and bust balls. It's in the culture. It's in the water. There's nothing wrong with either of those folks. I'm not going to make a case against them. However, there's value in us sensitive folks. Our culture just doesn't honor it. Our culture isn't terribly excited about deep thinkers who want to pause and reflect before answering. We like people who just, you know, snap, snap, snap. Let's have a response already. If we now have other-oriented perfectionism, so that's I need you to be perfect, this is often, this will come up for sensitive people as well. So highly sensitive people, if you're thinking about a brain that's deeply, thinking deeply about all inputs in their environment, this is a cohort of folks who often struggle in their relationships because they will have this other-oriented style of perfectionism in play. They can see patterns emerge in their relationships where they detect, oh, so I like doing this thing and you like doing that thing. I can now project likely scenarios in the future where we will have conflicts. And if I see that as being a deal breaker, I'm going to go ahead and break it off right now. So it's not aggressive other-oriented perfectionism, but it's nevertheless very problematic. So this frequently will come up in relationships with HSPs. You'd think we'd be great at relationships, and to some extent we are. It's why people might be drawn to us HSPs. But our neuroses can manifest in this other-oriented perfectionism, whereby we say to our partners, unless you can meet all of these requirements, I'm too afraid of having to assert myself and negotiate for myself, so I'm just going to leave. And that's heartbreaking for a prospective partner. So that's how it can manifest with other-oriented perfectionism. And then, of course, self-oriented perfectionism. That's that critic that's constantly online. And often that internal critic began as a survival mechanism. Sensitive people are often made fun of in school. Many of us are, not just HSPs, but they're often told, you're too sensitive, you crybaby, you're thin-skinned, grow a pair, all of this. And we learn very quickly by observing our environment and go, oh, so this isn't normal. I'm not the average. Those folks out there seem to be doing something right. So I'm just going to do what they do and hope that no one notices that it's destroying me. I'll give the example I like to give a lot is slumber parties, because as a kid, I could not comprehend why children liked this. Like, wait. So I'm going to not sleep in my own bed, which I happen to really love. Thank you very much. I'm going to leave, go into a new home with new smells, new sounds, new all the things. I'm going to hang out with a bunch of kids who all have different emotional needs and desires and orientations. And I'm going to stay the night. But why though? But why? Like, I love you. You are my friend, and I want to do nice things for you, and I would like you to do nice things for me. But why this? What? So often, this I use as an example because very early on I learned, oh, well, if I want friends at all, I've got to do what others do when in Rome. And so I quickly discovered all of my go-to intuitions about what pleases me. I learned to override that at a very, very early age for the sake of pleasing others, because I didn't want anyone to discover that I was so sensitive, because they got so much joy out of this stuff and I didn't seem to get that same joy. So I just thought there must be something wrong with me. So if I just pretend to love it, well, maybe they'll love me and everyone will be happy. I mean, maybe not me, but better to please others and be one of a member of a group than to disappoint them and be alone. You know, kids are very, very gifted at figuring this stuff out. And so that self-oriented perfectionism, where it's like I learn quickly that, oh, whatever it is I am, it's not in alignment with the culture. I need to fix it. Otherwise, I could be outcast. And because I am a social creature, not social as in me, Leah, I love to go out and socialize all the time, but I am a homo sapien, and homo sapiens are social by nature. I don't want to be the outcast. So this inner critic comes online that is perpetually keeping me focused and in line so that no one discovers me. But that voice gets louder and louder, and more things fall in to the not okay bucket. And that can be, again, exhausting. So these are the ways in which a highly sensitive person might fall into even any one of these three. Socially prescribed, hey, the culture doesn't match me. I'm going to hurry up if I just wear the right things, if I just get the right job. Well, then I will be validated by the culture. Other-oriented is, I need you to be perfect for me because otherwise I might have to negotiate with you and I can't do that. So either you need to be perfect, a perfect match for me, my perfect soulmate, my perfect friend, or we just need to cut ties because I'm too scared to have to to defend myself and to advocate because I don't really believe that you'll accept me as I am. And then self-oriented is I must be perfect all the time and no one can see me sweat. Because, and I have to, that I can find, if I find any flaws in my own work, then it wasn't right. And it won't matter what anyone else tells me. It won't matter when people say to me, it's okay, you did fine, it was great, nice job. I will always notice all of the ways I could have done it better. And so there we go. Perfectionism and highly sensitive people. This is why. And now to kind of bring it back into the triangle, the triad. For HSPs in particular, you have to think, okay, so we're probably going to be more prone to perfectionism. And every time that we get stressed, our adrenal glands get activated by a lower threshold of stimulus. So like I mentioned, these are the kind of folks who say, oh, I love music. I just don't love super loud concerts. You know, oh, I love networking in small groups. Like I love my little BNI group, but I'm not really super excited about going to some large conference. Like how I randomly threw up BNI. It could be any group, the Chamber of Commerce, whatever. I love my 10 ladies that I meet with once a week. Not crazy about having to go to the huge mumbo jumbo, like, it's not just a conference. What is that word I'm looking for? Oh, well, it's gone. Large masses of people don't like it. So if it's true that things that are happening in my everyday life are felt for me as more activating, remembering that window, instead of a 2 to an 8, my ceiling is lower. I prefer, my ceiling is more closer to a 6 or a 7. Well, that means every time that I get stimulated by something that's a 7 or higher, my adrenal glands are going to respond with more of that stress hormone in an attempt to arm me with energy. So my body isn't trying to attack me, it's just trying to arm me with what it perceives I need. Well, like that means I'm going to be more likely to reach adrenal fatigue faster than the average person. If now I'm exhausted in an attempt to be perfect, and I'm finding that I'm less and less capable of meeting the demands of whatever my internal critic expects of me, well, now I'm going to start to move into that realm of depression because, well, I can't keep up. And that means I'm not enough. Someone's going to discover me. Oh my God, I'm not enough. I'm not enough. Why bother? I'm just going to retreat. I don't want to go out into that world. It's too hard. I'm a sensitive person in an insensitive world. I just need to retreat. I can't participate anymore. I don't want to. I don't want to be here. I'm so tired. Please just let me go away. Please go away. And then what that actually leads to is any time that one does go back into the world, that perfectionism gets activated more quickly. Ugh. Yuck. So with all of that having been said, the question now becomes, what do we do about it? What are the tools that we have at our disposal? And how might being more sensitive be an asset? How can we take our sensitivity and our propensity toward perfectionism and use it and ally with it and see this as a tool as opposed to a liability? Well, let's go. Number one, authenticity. Cultivating a sense of authenticity. This is a big one that Brené Brown, for example, talks about in her book, Gifts of Imperfection. But what the hell does that mean? Like being authentic, like, okay, whatever, I don't know what that means. So cultivating authenticity really is the ability to let go of what people think. To acknowledge that people might not like you, and that is okay. So there's a book that was written by an author whose name has escaped me. I am so sorry. Perhaps I'll put it in the show notes. But the book is called The Courage to be Disliked. I speak to this book all the time because it was, I don't want to use the phrase game changer, but the language it utilized was extremely helpful and therapeutic for me. So the whole premise of the book is it's utilizing Adlerian psychology alongside, I forget what philosophy, I want to say it was Stoicism, but I'm not positive about that. At any rate, it's a conversation that's taking place between a wise old man and a young man who's trying to make his way in the world. And the wise man is sort of like a Miyagi or a Yoda or, you know, somebody who's, he's been around the block kid and he knows what's up. And you, you little daffodil, you, you think that you know what's happening. And of course you think that because you're young and you know everything. And this young man is lamenting about the woes of being human and the difficulty and all of the expectations that are just like put upon him. Well, this older man is basically constantly driving home the fact that if you really want to live an authentic life, you're going to have to be willing to be disliked. That takes, that's real courage. Anything less than that, you're lying to someone. If everyone in your life likes you, you have failed at life because you're lying to someone. Most likely, one of those someones might even be yourself. If everyone you meet likes you, you've done it wrong. If most of the people you meet dislike you, but there are some who really like you, you're doing it right. Even if most people dislike you, the ones who do really, really like you. And here's the idea. If you are truly yourself and you are radically honest, not honest for, so when I say honest, I'm talking about the kind of honesty that follows in alignment with like NA or AA circles where they say, you know, to the filter you use for what you say, there's three. Number one, is it honest? Number two, is it kind? And number three, is it necessary information? So I'm not talking about honesty that is brutal force, like a punch to the face kind of honesty. Like, ew, that's gross. Like, ugh, God, you look fat. All right, well, I mean, okay, what? I'm just being honest, they might say. All right, yeah, maybe, but the delivery could use some work. There is a way to deliver feedback that doesn't have to be a blunt force. And next, was that necessary? Was that information they didn't have and they need? That's very different, by the way, from a person who comes out in a dress and says, what do you think? And you look and you kind of tilt your head and you go, you know, I've got to be honest with you. I don't think that dress is flattering on you. I think you can find something better. Let's keep looking. It was kind. It wasn't, you are not a flattering person. You are, I don't know, insert whatever insult is your drive home insult. It can be you are ugly. You are... fat is a big one, unfortunately, in our culture, although I know plenty of fabulously beautiful human beings who are fat. Thank you very much. You are, you can go too skinny, so bony. You can go too busty, so, too slutty, too, what? So whatever your thing is that is a triggering insult for you, you don't have to go there. You can simply, it's one thing to say you are blank. It's another thing to say, huh, it is blank, or your behavior is blank. So in terms of being willing, you know, giving honest feedback to a person, someone who is radically honest and who is also practicing the it's honest and giving, it's necessary and it's kind, and who in an as they engage in that way with the world, are finding people are rejecting them, that's actually a good sign. Seems a little counterintuitive, but it is. So as an example, or not even an example, I'll to validate this argument or to kind of give it some juice. If I am being honest with my likes and my dislikes, let's say I go on a date and a guy says, hey, do you like football? And I say, well, you mean like soccer or like American football? Like, what are we talking here? He goes, you know, football, like American football. I don't, personally. I don't hate that other people like it. I don't have any, you know, moral objections to it. But it doesn't do anything for me. It's neutral. So if I'm trying to please him, I might say, oh, yes, I love that. You know, oh, yes. And then quickly Google whatever the football games are that are playing. Oh, I'm rooting for, I don't know, insert team, Green Bay, whatever. Because I want you to think that I'm with you. Well, the problem with this is that there are people in the world who feel the same way that I do about football. Who just feel like, yeah, whatever. And if I'm really honest and I'm on this date and they say, how do you like football? And I go, Well, he might reject me. It's true. He probably will, in fact, because he might be thinking, well, crap, I want to find a partner who would want to go to football games with me. By being honest, I've benefited both of us. I've made it easier for him to determine that I'm not his person, and I've made it easier for someone with an earshot to hear me and go, hey, me too. I don't like football either. So the more honest we become, it's true, the more rejection we're going to feel. But also, the easier it will be for those who agree with us to find us. This is courage. This is authenticity. This is what is meant by authenticity. It's radical honesty to the point where I go out into the world and say, not only is it okay if I get rejected, it's a good sign. Not being a jerk, but being honest about my wants and my needs. What are my must-haves? What are my can't-stands? And how can I deliver that in a way that respects all parties? You don't have to like it. I'm going to tell you what it is anyway. So that's what is meant by authenticity. If you can cultivate the courage to be disliked, this can help combat perfectionism, because what it can do for you is give you the indicator of, oh, nice. I mean, I only have like 5 people that I can call upon at any given moment, but they're my people. This is my tribe. Number 2, identifying your something larger. This is, you know, everywhere you go, this is a big one. So Nietzsche is famous for his line, he who has a why can handle just about anyhow. I think I butchered the line, but you get the idea. If whatever it is you're engaged in and having to do is linked with your something larger, so your sense of values, your sense of purpose, your dharma, then it won't matter how stressful the event becomes, because it's not about you. So this is why parents, say even sensitive parents, are able to go to the mat for their kids, but they don't do that at all for themselves. It's like, well, yeah, but that's my kid. Like, I will die for my kid, not for me. Like, you can run me over. I don't care about my kid. Same with, and it's for a larger purpose. Like, I'm willing to fight and to die for my country. I'm willing to fight and to die for democracy. That's a hell of a thing to be willing to relinquish your life for the sake of an idea. Whoa. So then that brings us to, yeah, well, that's cute, but how do I identify my something larger? If I'm not religious, if I don't have a propensity toward a spiritual practice per se, how might I identify what my something larger is? Well, this is now coming from the Nagoski sisters' work. She it's very helpful. She's like, okay, well, first, what is it that makes you come alive? Think about it. What are things that when you're engaged in them, you lose all sense of time? Writing, poetry, music, running. What is it that when you're engaged in it, it's not even you doing it? It's something bigger than you. That can be one useful question. It's coming from Howard Thurman's question. It's my absolute favorite as a coach. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do that. Because what this world needs is more people who have come alive. So this now, if I'm linking it back to perfectionism, if we're constantly just trying to be perfect for other people, but we're not really engaging in the thing that we ourselves feel alive when we're engaged in, we are depriving the world of something beautiful. There is a reason that we love people who, you know, strike it out on their own, and we love mavericks. Because there's something about them that when we see them, we think, whoa, you made this thing. There was a thing that wasn't there before, and you brought it to this world. And you look fully alive while you're doing it. I want to be near you. What is it that makes you come alive? Go do it, because it will make our world more beautiful. And here's the thing. When you're engaged in that thing that just makes you come alive, perfectionism inherently has to take a back seat, because the voice of that thing inside you is so loud, so all-encompassing, that anything the inner critic might have to say to you about the subject just gets drowned out by the power of this something larger. But let's say that that was a little too vague a question for you. Another way you can pose the same question is much more pragmatic. What problems do you like to solve? And who are the people that you most like helping to solve those problems? Think about your Martin Luther King Jr.'s, your Gandhi's. Think about those folks who have done extraordinary acts of bravery. And they worked tirelessly. They worked themselves to the bone, and they didn't care. Well, they did, I'm sure, but it didn't matter, because this thing that I'm doing, it's not me doing it. It's God. It's the universe. It's something bigger than me. And I'm just this vessel. That's how it feels when you're engaged in the kinds of problems that you like to solve. So think about the kinds of things that people come to you and ask about. Maybe your friends, when they're really struggling with a problem, and maybe it's their relationship, it could be their creativity, it could be their job. Like, what are the things that when your friend calls and says, hey, you tend to be pretty good at this and I'd love some feedback. Not only are you willing to pick up the phone, but you're excited. You think, oh yeah, let's have this conversation. So for me, it's anything on the subject of burnout, effective leadership, health and wellness. Like, I had a loved one call me and say, hey, I understand that you know a thing or two about weight management and health and wellness. I'd love to have a conversation. Abso-flippin-lutely. Let's get on the phone. Let's go. We were on the phone for an hour. I don't like talking on the phone, but I loved talking on the phone for this conversation. And then that second part of the question, who do you most like to help? I figured out pretty quickly that, well, not quickly, it took me a while, but I worked my way into leadership positions a few times. And what I found is that I am perfectly adequate at leadership. I do it just fine. But in order for me to do an adequate job at being a leader, I have to work my ass off. Like, it is exhausting for me. And I'm sure it is for most people, but it's, if I'm going to be exhausted, I would at least like to think I'm doing a kick-ass job. But I don't. I do a fine job. No one complains. People who worked on my team would say, yeah, she's good. No complaints. She's fine. Meh. No one that was on my team when I was a leader ever said, oh my God, she's so inspiring. No, not really. Not as a manager, not as a director or anything along those lines. But what I'm really good at, I mean, this is me being arrogant, and I don't even care, because this is my superpower. I'm really good at identifying good leaders. It is so easy for me to spot one, because they're rare, frankly. But like, when I see that special something in another person, it's like, oh, I see you. I see you. And what I love doing is being their corner man. This is why when I talk about what it is I do in my coaching practice, I'll often say I work with sensitive leaders. I work with people who have an itch, a desire to make a difference in the world, and who are terrified to do it because they think it's got to be all or nothing. They're afraid that in order to go out and make the change that they want to make, it's going to take everything out of them. And I want to be that guy's corner man, or that woman's corner woman. I want to be the person who's like, no. I know you don't see you because you're too busy being inside of yourself, and that's rough. I have the privilege of being just outside of you, and I'm telling you, you are magic. You are that. You've got that something. Please, for the love of God and all that is holy, do not back out of this. We will make sure that this is sustainable for you. We will put in systems. I know that you are afraid of burnout. We will make sure you don't, because this world needs you desperately. I've got you. So the kinds of problems I like to help people solve, burnout. The kinds of people I like to work with, people who are either current or aspiring leaders. And that can mean people who want to make their own, like, go out and strike it on their own as an entrepreneur, or people who want to lean into leadership roles in their company. Not because, so it's not like, oh, I've been there, I can do that well, so watch me do it. It's, I've been there and I can do that fine. But I'm seeing you, and I'm telling you, you are an outlier. All you need is a little bit of support and an occasional reminder of how to take care of yourself while you do this thing. So now I turn that question back to you. I'll say, too, there's a reason why I'm willing, even despite my perfectionistic tendencies, I'm willing to take a lot of risks in this area. Because when I'm in these conversations with the kinds of people I like to work with, it's not me having them. It's not about me in that moment. It's about them. because I am so selfishly hungry for effective leadership in this world. And let's face it, we need it everywhere. We need it in our businesses. We need it in our politics. Look at the world right now. And you tell me, do we or do we not need better leaders? If the answer is no, then you're crazy. I love you, but no, you're out of your damn mind. You've been so deprived of good leadership, you haven't seen it yet. Like, an effective leader is someone who, as Brené Brown would say, it's power with and power to, not power over. So an effective leader is someone who says, I want to inspire you to become the best version of yourself. And together, let's make the world a better place. That's a person who leads. Someone who just wants power over is, I want to be in charge because I'm a special little snowflake and you better listen to me because or else, whatever. We don't need any more of that. So for me, when I'm having these conversations, I'm willing to bumble around and stumble and get it wrong. I'm willing to be imperfect. I'm willing to take rejection because this thing that I feel the world needs so badly is bigger than me. It's bigger than my ego. It's bigger than my heartbreak. I want it that badly. And it's so in alignment with what I think we need that I'm willing to fall on my ass over and over and over again to help. That's what helps me conquer my perfectionism. It's something bigger than me. Next one, if you want to conquer perfectionism and adrenal fatigue and depression, that delicious little triad, you have to prioritize pleasure. Oh my goodness, this is so rough for my little HSPs because it's interesting. Highly sensitive people are, their dopamine receptors get saturated much quicker. It's not that we don't need pleasure. It's that we're pleased by our threshold for pleasure is lower. And we're not as clingy with our pleasures. So often, highly sensitive people rarely develop addiction problems. Or if they do, it's often an addiction to, I think depressants is what they're called. Basically things that tone things down. So a highly sensitive person, if they're going to have any kind of addiction, it would probably be to something like pot. So marijuana, or maybe Xanax, because they're trying to turn the volume down. They're not likely to fall into an addiction around alcohol because our systems are too sensitive and it's agitating. They're probably not going to fall prey to methamphetamines because, generally speaking, sensitive people don't want more energy. They have enough. Thank you very much. I'm already overstimulated. So this is a group of folks who often will say, pleasure. What? This is a group who, if I start talking about behavior change and the importance of having a reward for those behaviors, they'll say, so can you give me an example? Because I can't think of one. Which, how sad is that, by the way? This is where we live. In a world where we don't even necessarily know what pleasure is. So here's what I'll say. One useful tool here in the realm of pleasure is to look at your love language, strangely enough. So this was Gary Chapman, who wrote a book on the 5 love languages. It was originally for marriage, but then he's since, crafted it for being at work or friendship and so on. But in essence, what he wrote is we seem to have... when we give and receive love, many of us seem to fall into a camp where our means to communicate our love is in one of these 5 quote-unquote languages. And the 5 love languages are physical touch, quality time, acts of service, words of affirmation, and tangible gifts. So this might manifest with, for me, my top 2 is quality time and physical touch. If you want to say I love you to me, look at me. When I'm talking, ask me a question. Oof, curiosity is so sexy. You don't have to like what I'm saying, but if you're curious about me, just got hot in here. And if you touch me. Now, obviously, it's different forms of touch and so on, but I love hugs. And multiple variations of touch. And yeah, sure, it also extends into sex and sexuality, but it's all the gradations in between holding of hand, a brush of your hand on my shoulder, the putting your hand on the small of my back, or a kiss on the cheek. Like, all of this is just luscious to me. Gifts? I'm a minimalist. Like, I don't want a lot of stuff. So if you give me things, I will appreciate the gesture, but it won't feed my tank. Now, for someone else, though, maybe you love gifts. Just to be clear, just because you love gifts, by the way, it does not mean you are quote-unquote materialistic. Here's an example of something that's just real. I dated a man who was fabulous at gift giving, and he was extremely thoughtful in the gifts that he provided. So he's the guy who would, he discovered that I liked tea, and he went out of his way to get a tea kettle that you could push a button and it would have the right temperature gauge on it for the appropriate tea leaf. Like, what? I still have it. Like, the relationship dissolved, but every time I look at that, it makes me think of him and it makes me smile. And from his perspective, that was his way of saying, I'm thinking of you even when you're not around, and I want to find a way to make your life easier. Here's a representation of that love. It's really lovely. So if you know what your love language is, you can use this to kind of key into your pleasure centers. If you love touch, you can prioritize time with your beloved. And, you know, bow, chicka, bow, bow. If you happen to have someone who's in proximity and who's consenting adult. But let's say that you're single and you love physical touch. Then you schedule time with a masseuse to get a massage. Let's say, though, that you don't have the money for that, or you don't have access. Perhaps what you do is you throw a towel in the dryer so that when you get out of the shower, you can wrap yourself up in a nice warm towel. Or maybe you have a blanket that's very lush and soft. So what kind of sensations can you provide yourself with and prioritize that pleasure? So another one is just laughter. So engaging in things that make you laugh. You can look at silly animal videos. You can watch Comedy Central and, you know, make things that gives you the chuckle. So if you're trying to combat perfectionism, why would this help? Well, predominantly because pleasure, if you prioritize it well, feeds the system so that your discernment can come online. Every time you please yourself in any capacity, it is a reminder that you are inherently worth pleasing. It's beyond just this idea of, I need to do all of my to-dos first, and then I will have earned my pleasure. No, 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 no. If you do not prioritize pleasure, your to-do list will never end, and you will always be pushing the goalpost out a little bit further. So when you prioritize pleasure, it gives you that reminder of, oh, this is why life is worth living. Next one, your relationships. So navigating relationships and how to engage in a way that reduces our needs, our perfectionism. So one is, any time that we recruit support on something that is too hard for us, so every time we ask for help, what's helpful to remember, we often hate doing it because if we ask for help, they might reject us. And even if they do it, they might not do it right. So screw it, I'm just going to do it myself. But think about how good it feels when someone says to you, hey, I could really use some help. Would you mind grabbing the other side of this table and helping me? Especially when it's that friend who never asks for help and you think, oh, you asked me? It is a gift that you give when you ask for some assistance. So long as you're not, you know, taking advantage of them. Another thing to consider is meeting people in the middle. So this is where we get tripped up in perfectionism with our relationships. We get into this, well, I'll say no to everybody because in order for me to feel at ease in social circumstances, I need to be perfect. And if I can't be perfect, I'm not going at all. But that's really hurtful to our people. So practicing the art of, hey, like when someone says, hey, you want to come with me to this theme park? Maybe say, well, no, I don't really want to go to a theme park. That's a little loud for me. But I would love to spend time with you. So maybe we could meet at a park and go for a walk. It doesn't have to be today, but, you know, definitely enjoy the theme park. But that's probably not going to work for me. But I'd love to see you. So we forget sometimes that we can make a request for something that fits us better. And more often than not, people will shrug and go, oh, sure, that sounds great. That simple. And then finally, saying no effectively. This is one that Brené Brown says all the time, like choose discomfort over resentment. Because anytime you feel resentment, it's usually a boundary that you weren't enforcing and that someone else crossed, often unknowingly. So in order to say no effectively, here's a couple of tips that can be helpful. Preemptively schedule time for rest and play and recovery. And you don't have to say that you've scheduled it for that. But when someone asks you, what are you doing on Saturday? Let's say you've scheduled a day to yourself. You can say, ooh, sorry, I'm busy on Saturday. How about Sunday? They don't need to know that you're busy being by yourself. So you've basically said no and then provided an alternative. And when you're providing, sort of trying to set the groundwork for an effective boundary, it's assertive, not passive. So passive is, sure, whatever you like. Aggressive is, hell no. Passive aggressive is, I guess. And then assertive is, well, I'd love to see you, but that won't work for me. But please ask again. It's that simple. So when we ask for help from others, and when we say no when we mean no, and we say yes when we mean yes, and when we negotiate on our own terms, this helps remind us, it helps give us experiences that tell us we don't have to be perfect. We just have to be clear. Clear is kind. Next one, creativity. So here's the difference between, this is now coming from Kelly McGonigal's work on how to make stress your friend. If you're feeling stressed and if you're feeling like you did something imperfectly, one of the best things you can do with that is have a creative outlet. What happened? How can you take your disappointment, your frustration, and craft it into artwork? How can you see this as opportunity, as an opportunity to create something beautiful out of it? If you failed at something, if you did something imperfectly, what if you wrote a blog about it and then someone else saw that blog and goes, oh, I'm not the only one? And or you can get involved in something that you know you're really bad at, but it's just play to you. So finger painting. When I talk about creativity, I'm not talking about doing more of the stuff that you're going to be critical of. Do something way out of left field that is so out of your realm of familiarity. So I'm not saying something that makes you uncomfortable, but just something that's very unfamiliar. And it helps you cultivate beginner's mind. So do something that just feels light and silly and fruitful, but not really fruitful. Like, it's not about being productive. It's just about having a moment of creativity and play. Because what that helps you to do is remove the comparison, remove the sense of what's perfect, because you're so new at it, you can't. And it helps you to channel the feels into something beautiful. The next one, and now this is, nourishment, so nutrition. As it relates to the perfectionism, adrenal fatigue, depression trap, one thing I'll say that can be helpful is really trying to help support your adrenal glands by eating on a regular basis something that has some protein and something that has some fiber, because it helps balance your blood sugar. Even if you have a cookie on the side as well. I'm not telling you not to eat the sweet things. I'm just saying if you have something with some protein in it, that helps support the adrenal glands. Something with some fiber helps support the digestive system, which, by the way, is the area responsible for helping us cultivate GABA, which helps reduce those excitatory neurons and helps us get less feisty. So balance your blood sugar. You'll be a happier Homo sapien. But, and this is important, when it comes to nourishment, practicing the 80-20 rule. 80% of the time, eat nourishing, healthy food. 20% of the time, eat whatever the puck you want. Don't go so toward the realm of orthorexia, so perfectionism with food. And on top of that, see experiences as a means of nourishment as well as food itself. So as an example, think about the things that bring you joy and engage in them. Because if you have no place for joy, you're going to be much more likely to find your addiction in the realm of food addiction. Because, well, I can't have pleasure in other areas, but at least I can eat this tasty thing. So see nourishment as beyond just what's on your plate. What are things that feed you? What are experiences? So going on a hike and seeing something that provides you an experience of awe, hugging a friend, all of that. Next one, this idea of growth. So this kind of links back to your idea of you're something larger. And this is now going to link back to with Kelly McGonigal's work, where she talks about stress as something that can become your friend. So when we feel stress, and the stress that we feel is associated with our purpose, our sense of meaning, our bodies respond physiologically very different than if the stress we're experiencing feels unnecessary. So, let's say that I've walked in and I'm taking an exam, and I was told in advance, this exam is damn near impossible. We're just testing to see how far you can go with it and how long you'll stick to it. That's all. Now I'm realizing, oh, so that's why. It's supposed to be hard. No biggie. I'll still get stressed, but I know that they're not trying to see me be perfect. They're just trying to see how far I can go. It's a curiosity experiment. Versus they just give me the test. My body will respond physiologically very different, and I'll be more likely to give up sooner if I think that I'm not making any headway in it. And so what Kelly McGonigal was able to articulate is, if the stress we feel, the heart racing, the sweaty palms, is associated with something positive, our bodies accommodate the stress, our arteries expand to accommodate the increased blood flow, our heart rate still goes up, but it doesn't feel like a heart rate going up in our, versus when we are experiencing stress that we perceive as negative, our arteries constrict. And hence, if that happens often enough, we get high blood pressure. So when we see failure as a good sign, every time we feel the zing of failure, we think, oh, that means that I actually did something hard. I fell on my butt and it hurt, but that means I was courageous. That is a powerful antidote to perfectionism. And the thing I'm going to use here, I don't know who the original architect of this concept was. I know there's a number of psychologists who use it, but I don't know who the original author was. But it's this idea of the comfort zone, stretch zone, panic zone. These three zones, to kind of break it down. Comfort zone, I'm happy, I'm easy, everything here. I can navigate this world blind. But I can get bored. I won't grow here. It gets sticky. Apathy, depression might manifest if I stay there too long. The stretch zone is where it's a little outside of our comfort, but it's a stretch. So you can even use the metaphor of an actual stretch. Like it's when you're doing a yoga pose and they say, okay, just go a little bit more. And there's this point and you can feel it in your body where it's, oh yeah, oh, that feels so good. Yes. It's that morning stretch. In our lives, when we engage in things that are just in that stretch zone, so we know we're not professionals at it, we know we're not experts, but we're still going to be willing to push the boundaries a little. It's uncomfortable, but it's the right kind of uncomfortable. It's the right kind of burn. That's where we get inspired. It's where we feel invigorated. It's where we feel a sense of flow. So that's Mikhail Chuzkevsky. Oh, I never pronounce his name correctly, but he wrote a book on flow. I know his first name is Mikhail, and I can visualize his last name, but I always butcher it. My apologies. But that place where the resources we have meets the challenge that we're facing. So we might feel flow in the kitchen if we're good cooks or on a run, the runner's high. So that's the stretch zone. The panic zone is when we are sprinting. So that's where we're huffing and puffing and we're running like crazy. So as an example, let's say that you're talking about getting in front of other people. I hate talking in front of a live audience. I don't actually myself, but let's just say that's true. Well, my comfort zone might be, well, if I'm talking to three people, that's very comfortable. My stretch zone might be, well, if I have to do a presentation in front of 10 people, I can do it, but that's really hard. And my panic zone is I've been thrust out into a live audience of 50 plus people and I have to do it right now. Can I do it? Well, maybe, but that is severe panic zone. We want to do those panic zone activities sparingly, just like you would in your exercise. You don't want to sprint for an hour straight. You'll wreck your body. You have to have those areas of rest and recovery if you're going to do those sort of sprints. So when talking about growth, every time it's about being willing to fail, but in small bite-sized increments. It's practicing failure. It's getting good at it. So it's using your perfectionism to your advantage, in so much as you say to yourself, I'm going to get really good at failing. I'm going to be the best failer ever. I'm going to be the bestest at failing. It's where you say, I could say you're trying to learn a new language. This is hard for me because I love language so much. And estoy aprendiendo español ahora. And when I'm speaking with other people, I've gotten very good at phrases like muchas gracias para su paciencia. Thank you for your patience. lo siento, no hablo español bien, pero hablo un poquito de español. So I'm so sorry, I don't speak Spanish well, but I speak a little. These cues that I can indicate to others, like I'm trying, but please be patient with me. I'm so bad at this. Porque en español soy estúpida. En inglés soy muy inteligente, pero en español no. So for me, it's extremely uncomfortable to practice Spanish with a fluent speaker because, whew, talk about a lot of failure. So a miniature, my comfort zone is practicing Duolingo. My stretch zone is when I'm at a screening event and someone I know speaks Spanish predominantly. And I'm willing to kind of say, you know, hola, buenos dias. You know, lo siento, no hablo español bien, pero, you know, hablo un poquito. And often, I've got to tell you folks, like the degree of compassion and kindness that at least the folks I've been exposed to, it's just, it always melts my heart. Because frequently they'll say, oh, todo está bien, porque, you know, hablo un poquito de inglés. Like, so, you know, juntos estamos bien. Together we are okay. Like, I speak a little English. I speak a little Spanish. Muy bien. So that's my stretch zone. It's like I'm using these little, like, toddler phrases, and I'm gradually extending into a space that's difficult, but I'm not panicking. Panic zone. You thrust me in the middle of Mexico City and you say, sink or swim, babe. Like, that's panic zone. Because not only is everyone speaking fluently, maybe many people do speak English, but they're speaking fluently and very quickly. And I can't keep up. I'm panicking. That's not helpful. Because what can happen is that we end up in a panic zone too long, burn ourselves out, and then not only do we go back into our comfort zones, but our comfort zone retreats. The radius of our comfort zone gets smaller and smaller. And this is what happens quite frequently with sensitive leaders. They push themselves in the panic zone because they're trying to keep up with the culture's ideal. What they haven't realized is they are actually fantastic leaders, but they have to do it a little differently. They are the smartphones of leaders. They need to recharge more frequently. Very high functionality. They're going to have high EQ. They're going to be very good at big picture planning. They're going to be fantastic at negotiation with their people and defending their people and being advocates. It's all gravy, baby, but they will get exhausted much faster than the average person. Just like a smartphone versus a flip phone. Smartphone, great functionality, but if you do not recharge it, it is a fancy, shiny piece of junk. The same thing happens with HSPs. Particularly leaders. So the goal is to play in the stretch zone and then come back to the comfort zone, stretch zone, comfort zone, stretch zone, and then occasionally, sure, panic zone, but then retreat. Because what happens over time is the comfort zone expands. Our stretching starts to increase the radius of our comfort zone, such that if I regularly, let's say using the public speaking model, if I regularly start to engage in speaking with an audience of 10 or more people, well, maybe over time, 15, like 10 becomes my comfort zone, and now 15 is a stretch, and so on and so forth. If I regularly engage in these bite-sized conversations with people and start getting positive feedback, well, then over time, maybe I'll extend into other subjects, even if I flounder. So seeing failure as an opportunity to get good at it. Use your perfection to your advantage. And when you fail, look back, look behind you and go, yeah, I failed. Yeah, you're on it. And I'm good at it now. Look how good I'm getting at failing. I fell on my tush and I'm getting right back up because it was worth it. Next one is exercise. So this is now getting, it won't necessarily help with perfectionism, but it will help you complete the stress cycle that perfectionism can get you into. So perfectionism, that when you're trying to constantly be vigilant, produces stress in the body. Stress is basically cortisol and adrenaline. If you exercise, it uses that stress. It uses up the adrenaline, it uses up the cortisol. And then you're right back to where you started. So anyone who suffers from perfectionism, I will often tell them, you have got to move your body, because the problem with perfectionism is it lives in your head. Movement lives in the body, and it helps move the thoughts along much more effectively. So for perfectionists, you want to stop your perfectionism on the spot, go move, pace. You know, I'm not talking about doing runs if you don't like running. I'm talking dance in a towel and sing into your hairbrush. I'm talking pace in the living room. I'm talking go for a hike and see something beautiful in nature. Get out of your head, because your head is no longer your friend. Get back in your body, because then your body can remind your head that everything's okay. And finally, rest. 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 Examples of what I mean by this. In order to combat perfectionism, you have to have discernment. You have to be able to identify what are the things, like what is healthy striving and when have I gone too far? You have to be able to identify, is this me saying yes to a project because I actually have capacity for it? Or is it me not wanting to disappoint someone? To be able to answer those questions, you need discernment. Ironically, the more tired we become, the more perfectionistic we become, because we've lost our ability to have perspective. If you want to have less perfectionism, you need to be better rested. You might recall some of this. If you ever had a good night of sleep, you're less likely to feel the pain of rejection when someone gives you constructive feedback. You'll still feel it, but it won't be as intense. So, what do I mean? Number one, craft green zones in your day. So think like a city planner. The reason we love San Francisco and Manhattan is because they both have green zones. With San Francisco, it's Golden Gate Park. In Manhattan, it's Central Park. Could you build stuff on those places? Sure. Real estate tycoons would love to put a building in the middle of Golden Gate Park, I'm sure. But no one would want to live in a city that has no beauty in it. Much the same way as no one wants to live a life with no green zones in it. Rest is not something that anyone is going to give you, ever. Rest is something you take, and it is something you defend with your life. So plot out and schedule zones in your day that are for rest and recovery. Prioritize your sleep. See yourself like that smartphone, and remember to recharge. Because remember, if you don't recharge, you're the piece of junk. I mean, I love you, but you're useless. I know this because I have some experience with this. If I have not been slept, fed, pet, and played with at some point, those are my needs. My needs are few, but they are non-negotiable. If I have not been intellectually stimulated, if I have not been pet, if I have not been walked, if I have not been napped, like I turn into this fusser bucket of a person, and no one wants to hang out with that guy. You might think that when you're not resting, you can wear that like a badge of honor, but you're the guy no one wants to hang out with anymore because you're resentful and you're tired and you're cranky and no one likes that person. So it's if you're feeling like a lot of resentment all the time, that's not a world problem. That's a you problem. You didn't craft any green zones in your day. No one wants to live in that city, least of all you. The next thing I'll say too, in terms of how much to craft, for a highly sensitive person, I give this algorithm all the time. It's not mine. This is Elaine Aaron talking. 8 to 10 hours in bed, because you want to optimize your chance of getting 7 to 8 hours of actual sleep. 1 to 2 hours of quiet contemplation and reflection. 1 whole day off a week where you have no plans. And 4 weeks off each year. Doesn't have to be like all 4 weeks in a row. It can be a week here, 4 days there, 2 weeks over here, 3 days, whatever. But at the end of the year, you want to have taken the equivalent of 4 weeks off for vacation. It's a tall order, I know, but these are the things that can help you have more discernment and reduce the intensity and frequency of your perfectionism driving the car. We are 100 minutes in, folks. You have been a fabulous co-pilot. Thank you for sticking with me if you have made it this far. So delighted to be here. And we have finally reached the last of my little tips and tricks. However, having said all of this, I do have a sort of, as I'm wrapping this up, If, as you were listening to me, you have any questions, there's any part of you thinking, ooh, I'd like more clarification on blank, please reach out to me. My email is Leah, L-E-A-H, at thehealthysensitive.com. You can go to my website, www.thehealthysensitive.com, and there you'll find resources. You can join the online community that I'm now going to be much more active in. And also, you are more than welcome. I would be absolutely delighted if you wanted to book a coaching session. And I'm saying this to you because every intro session is always complimentary. So you can book a session and it's no strings attached, all enthusiasm and no pressure. And that gives you an opportunity to kind of flesh some of this out. So let's say that you heard this and you thought, oh, I'd love to have a longer conversation, but I don't feel like I don't know if I want to commit to coaching. Totally fine. You are welcome to just schedule a session. I have a meet and greet for 30 minutes. You can do a 60 minute, you can do a 90 minute deep dive, totally up to you. So with that, I do believe we are done. So all I can say now is I am so delighted to be back. I am now firmly planted in my stretch zone by launching into my private practice. So you get to see me flounder. So have some fun with that, folks. And this will be an interesting experiment whereby I get a chance to walk my talk. Let's see if I can really do the stuff I'm claiming that you all should do. Have a fabulous day, ladies and gentlemen. Take good care, and I will be keeping in touch much more frequently and hearing from you soon. Bye.